Good morning. Can everybody hear me okay? Can everybody hear me okay?
I can hear you just fine.
Thank you.
All right.
So, a couple of weeks ago, long after I had set the name of the talk, and it was in the title, in the program, on the website, I finished the first draft of the module that I'll be talking about. And I sent it to my friend, the Pearl Guru and module writer extraordinaire, Professor Damien Conway. And he took a look at it and he wrote back. He said, you know, it may not be so new, because it turns out that Dijkstra wrote a monograph about it in the Communications of the ACM in 1975. And I don't know that anybody's done anything with it since, but you know, you should be aware of that. So, you know, in all honesty, I have to retitle the talk. The first point I want to talk about is, you know, what is scripting? I think that people use the term script versus program very loosely. And I'd really like to try to formalize a definition that can help us to talk about it. I mean, a script is a program. Right? There's no question about that. I mean, you can't really hold scripts apart in the universe from programs and say these are two different animals. But there is a difference, I think. So some people, when they talk about scripts versus programs, they say that it's entirely based on what language it is. If it's Perl, if it's Python, if it's Ruby, of course, if it's a shell, it's a script. If it's C, C++, Java, C#, etc., it's a program. I'm not sure why this is a useful distinction. I mean, you know, that just says, you know, it's either in one language or another, and so why can't you just say this is a C program, this is a Perl program? My slide. There we go. Other people say that if the language lets you or makes you manage memory directly, it's not a scripting language. And if it's dynamically typed, then it's not a general purpose programming language. But my question to that is, that would make Java a scripting language and would make Lisp what? another thing people talk about a lot are how the program is run. They say that if it's compiled, it's a program. If it's interpreted, it's a script. But what about byte-compiled languages, like Perl, like Python, like Ruby? And once again, Lisp kind of throws a ball of wax in that, because, of course, you can have interpreted Lisp, and you can also have compiled Lisp. So some people take the nihilist ways out. They say that scripts are programs, programs are scripts, and scripting is just a word we shouldn't say in polite company. I claim that program is not the same as script, and that script is not the same as program. But I do agree that scripts exist in the universe of programs. So my proposal for how to talk about scripts as separate from programs, or rather as a subset of programs, is that scripts are programs that have a few characteristics generally in common, though there are exceptions to every one of these rules. One is that it makes heavy use of the environment. And what I mean by that is that it tends to have some persistent sort of effect outside of itself. That it's not simply crunching numbers, it's not
It's not generally, simply encapsulating an algorithm, for instance. One thing about it is that they almost never define, and I would claim never export, complex data structures. They may make use of complex data structures, very complex data structures, but for the most part, there's little reason to write a new data structure in a script. Scripts don't usually have an outer event loop, and they don't demonize. So there are obviously a lot of scripts that have an outer loop that may be indeterminate. But that's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about an event loop. And I'm talking about programs that go into the background and become demons. The next one is a little less true than the others. But scripts usually are run by the author of the script or some agent of the author, like, crontab or apt or something like that. Or they're run by a sysadmin who may or may not be the author. And in general, they're written by users that are somewhat more aware of what the script is doing. I would say that IRC scripts are probably the big counterexample of that. People have no idea, and of course, rootkit scripts are another example of something that people have no idea what they're running. But for the most part, I think scripts are programs that the people running them have a fairly good idea of what the script is trying to accomplish, at least. And finally, they have a primary purpose of ensuring a given state obtains in the system. They run fairly linearly, and I'll get into that in a second. So just each of these points, just to make sure that I've kind of covered it completely. So what I meant by make heavy use of the environment: external programs, services, files, devices in the network. They may use complex data structures. They don't export them. So once again, I think that this third point is a little bit harder to understand. And my point is that scripts generally they run to completion for whatever completion means, and then they exit. And they're often run interactively. The fact that a script has a prompt loop, what do you want me to do now? Or a work list loop. I've got this big data set. I'm going to do something to each one. that doesn't make this point untrue. I think I covered this. But the author is probably you if you're in this room. The author's agent can be any program that will run your script. And as a sysadmin, you wear two hats, so you're both the user and the author of many of the scripts that you write. They have a primary purpose, like I said, of ensuring a given state obtains in the system. And what I mean by that is that scripts generally, they do something rather than compute something. And I know that's very fuzzy, but I think there's a real difference there. And it's by use of the external environment that we talked about a few slides ago. So why does this matter? It sounds like I'm engaging in kind of pedantic philosophy now, and why does it matter? Well, good programming methodology is pretty well researched. There's any number of programming methodologies that, and they come and go, and some of them last longer, like object orientation. Some of them come and go. But good scripting methodology is not really well researched. I think there's some style guides here and there. There's kind of old wives' tales about, a good script does this or that. But I don't think anybody's really talked about scripting methodology. And that's what I want to try to get towards. I'm going to use an example kind of throughout this talk. And it's really simple. And I know there are other ways to do this, some that would be better than writing a script, but you know, it works out as a good example. You want to mount a remote file system, in this case a scratch file system, via NFS from some remote file server. And you write a script that basically, you know, does exactly that. I'm omitting the code that actually like munges the arguments and everything. I think that we can just kind of skip that. But so the first thing I want to talk about is kind of the optimist way of writing this script. And you know, I think you'll recognize this from maybe your first year or so of scripting. Let me walk through this really quickly, because what we're doing is kind of similar to what we'll be doing later on. But what do? Well, you have to add the mount to the file system table. So you open up FSTab, you write the appropriate line to FSTab, and you close it. Then you make a scratch directory, and then you make the appropriate symlink. And then you, that obviously should be dollar scratch. I think I changed that slide. You need to turn on, I'm assuming a Red Hat Linux system here, you know, if we could write it different ways for different operating systems. You start up NFS services for boot time. I think my laser pointer just died. You start NFS services right now by doing a service start. You then can mount at boot time. Red Hat Linux has a little service called NetFS that basically just looks at what NFS file systems aren't yet mounted and mounts them, so that's convenient. So the problem with the script is that we may have a problem, but we don't know. Because if I can go back, there's no error checking at all. Right? And so the script just continues and goes on, and it may do very weird things, and then you have to pick up the pieces afterwards. But you, having scripted for more than, you know, a few months, you know better. And so you check for errors. And the typical thing that people do is if they encounter an error, they abort. So this is the new script. Here, when every single script, every single action we take, we open FSTab again, and if we can't open it, we die. We try to make the directory. If we can't make the directory, we die. So on and so forth. We symlink or die. We try to run a system command. If it gives an error, we die. So on and so forth. And it continues. The problem with this, well, it's better. I mean, it won't scribble randomly on your file system and end up in a really weird state. But it's really not perfect. There's now 9 places in that script where it might abnormally terminate. And that will leave the task incomplete. And once again, you have to pick up the pieces. And how are you going to do that? Well, if you're the author, you know what it was supposed to do, so you can probably pick up the pieces and get going again fairly well. But how would someone else, if they needed to run your script? So again, there's all these places that the script can die. And you know, it could go wrong at any of these points. And how would you pick up pieces? I mean, for instance, if somebody else who didn't write your script was running this script, if we failed at this, I think this is dead. There it goes. Say you failed at this point. It couldn't create the mount point. Well, the user may not realize that anything was written into FSTab. So they may fix whatever this is that didn't let you make the mount point, and then run the script again. This can lead to what we can call flooding the engine, because a user's first response to an unfamiliar error is often to retry exactly the same command again. And so fstab, as the error continues, fstab will get written to again and again and again. And that can cause problems. So I had a coworker once who wrote a script. He noticed that for a particularly problematic NFS file system, that he needed to remount it fairly frequently. It would just kind of, the mount would go away. And so noticing that it didn't seem to hurt if you typed mount, you know, slash foo, even if foo was already mounted, he had a great idea. He just put it into crontab. So a little while later, I was called in to discover why this machine had had reached its mount limit of 1,024 mounts, all overlapping on top of one another. So another problem with this script is that it's now spaghetti. You have 11 lines of functional code, but you have 21 lines of error handling. And this is a simple script. The worse, the larger the script gets, the worse it'll be. So what a lot of people do is they try to solve this problem by refactoring out some of the error code. So, you know, you notice that a lot of the system calls just involve saying, you know, try system, and if it fails, then die, you couldn't do it. So we create a subroutine, do or die. Once you do that, the script again fits on one slide. But you're still having 9 places where you can now abnormally terminate. And again, you know, my real problem with this is, what if there was already a mount point already ready for us, for whatever reason? The system is created with a mount point at that place, you know, slash MNT, for instance. Or the symlink was already created. Maybe you have a CF engine that runs in the background and created that symlink. You know, why do you abort a whole script because something goes right? So I once worked at a company that had very large feeds of commands coming in from an external customer. And these had about 40,000 lines of commands, and they could be things like, you know, add this file, move this file to a new place, delete this file. It was actually database data sets, but we could think of them as files. And there was one problem. You know, these feeds had 40,000 lines. If it failed, say, 20,000 lines through, the entire feed failed. And worse yet, it was rather optimistic. If it attempted to do a deletion and the file was already missing, it would error out because I couldn't delete it, so I must have a problem. So what would happen is that if you had any delete in the first 20,000 lines of the file that succeeded, and then you have an error, the whole thing errors out, you try to run the feed again, and guess what? It errors out at the very first delete. And the solution, I believe, in this case was move all the deletes to the very bottom of the feed, and then everything will work out just fine. So I think that the problem is that error checking, in the way that we traditionally do it, is syntactic. It's entwined with the implementation. It's based on the implementation. We're doing something in the code, therefore we're checking the code. And what we really need is we need error checks that are semantic. They're relevant to the task the script is trying to solve. And that's where what I have to talk about today, which is guarded commands, come to the rescue. As I mentioned at the beginning of the talk, guarded commands were first described by Dijkstra in 1975. These aren't exactly as he described them. Guarded commands consist of two parts. They have a condition, and they have an executable statement. And the condition guards the statement, and I'll show you what that means in a minute. I've implemented this in a module called commands :guarded. It's a pure Perl module. It makes use of no extra dependencies if you don't like to have to install 20 different modules to get the one you want. It is available on CPAN right now. It hasn't mirrored out all around the world yet, but if you go to search.cpan.org, you'll be able to find it there. What it implements are rectifying, re-verifying, deterministic Dijkstra guarded commands. That's what Damien Conway told me it was, so I'm just taking his word for it because he knows better than I. So, an example is this. The simplest guarded command involves a step. And a step has a name. It can be actually a string of however long you want, but if you want to avoid doing double quotes, you can just use a word like that. And it has a condition, and it has a statement. Another example that may make it clearer what I'm talking about is this one. So, we want to make sure that there's an identity file. And how do we do that? Well, we run SSH keygen. What steps do is pretty simple. This is kind of pseudocode, but unless the ensure clause is true, we do the using clause. And then we fail out unless the ensure clause is now true. Otherwise, we go on. So, in other words, is it already done? No, then do it. Now is it done? Now that you've done it? No? Then something's wrong. Give up. So back to the SSH keys example. What happens is the first thing that when Perl encounters this command is it checks whether there's an identity file already available. In this case, there's not. So we then run SSH keygen. Having run SSH keygen, we then look and see if there's an identity file now. If there is, we go on with the rest of the script. If there isn't, we fail with an error message that the step SSH keys did not complete. So, back to our NFS example. This script can be made better with guarded commands. First, we decompose the task into steps. And one way to do that is to go back to the prior script that was written sort of naively and look at the comments. What are the steps? You have to add the mount to the file system table, you create the mount point, you have to symlink to scratch, you start NFS services at boot, you start NFS services now, you mount at boot, you mount now. When you're ready to start writing your steps, for each step you have to write a necessary and sufficient condition for the desired result of the step. So for the first step, add a mount to a file system table. An appropriate test would be on this slide. So if we were to cat at CFS tab, attempt to match it against the source and the source's directory, some white space, and see if it's mounted at net source scratch. This test is semantic because it tests the result, not the implementation. It tests the fact that you want to have this file system available in FSDev. Remember that the implementation above was like this, that it printed source, scratch, space, net, source, scratch, space, NFS, and then the mount ops. It would be very tempting to write the test like this, instead of using a regular expression, saying, does it equal that string that we're about to print? But that's wrong, because this would be a syntactic test. It tests that this script has run before. In order to get more resiliency, you want to test for the semantic requirement. And the semantic requirement is simply that you have an appropriate line in the FSDev. It may be that the mount options were important, in which case you'd have to throw those in too, but the point is that you need to test for what you care about, not test for what you're doing. So, semantic tests make the script more resilient. It simply says what you need. An appropriate line in FSDev. No more, no less. If the environment changed, for instance, like I said before, if CFEngine, for instance, were to put the FSDev entry in initially, the script will continue to function without any change to the code. Semantic tests also serve as a debugging aid, because like in extreme programming, you write the test first and then you write the code. If your code is wrong, the test will fail. So, in the end, the test for this step looks like this. I implemented a little call called fgrep, which, you know, simple enough. It just greps a regular expression in a file. It's actually included in the module because it's often useful for these tests. And it just, exactly as I said, it checks semantically if you have a mount for that file system in FSDev. Once you've written your ensure clause, you write the code that'll cause the ensure test to succeed. In this case, we open the FSDev for appending, and we print the line. Same code, very similar to before. But look closely. Shouldn't we have an or die after the open? And don't we need to do a close? Why no, actually? Believe me, it's fine. If the open fails, the print to append the line to FSDev will also fail. And if the print fails, the ensure test will fail. You don't need to clutter your working code with gratuitous error checking. You only need to write the tests that matter to what your script is trying to accomplish. And that's lesson one. Trust your conditions, and the rest will follow. Now, about that close, instead of a bare file handle, which I think especially people who came from Perl 4 use, which, you know, all uppercase FSDev, we use the lexical variable for the file handle. Perl guarantees that lexical or my variables will be garbage collected at the end of a block. And that includes an ensure block. I'm sorry, a using block. So when a file handle object is garbage collected, it's automatically closed. So in this case, there's no need to close it. It'll be closed for you at the appropriate time. So the complete step, now that we put the insure and the using together, is we're going to add the mount to the file system table. What do we want to accomplish? Well, we want to have a line that looks like this that will guarantee that the file system is in FSTAB. And what do? We open the FSTAB for appending, and we print this line to it. And that, in turn, will cause the insure test to then succeed. So the complete script, which I'm not going to run through line by line, but I'll point out a couple of things, now looks like this. I've included the fgrep call because it's nice. Here's the step that we just went through. How do you create a mount point? Well, you want to ensure that there's a directory at scratch. So you make dir scratch. And you want to make sure that there's a symlink to scratch. So you make sure that if you read the link, that it points in the right place. And if it doesn't, you symlink. Some more from starting services. Notice that in this case, we run an external command. Notice the pipe at the end there. To see what the status of port map is. And we want to see if it's running. And we want to make sure that NFS lock is running. If it's not, we start them. And then finally, when we're all done with these dependent steps, we mount now. And what do? We check DF, see if it's there. So guarded commands have made this script better in a few different ways. First, resiliency. Semantic conditions make it more likely that the script will continue to behave if something changes. So, as I mentioned before, if something puts this symlink in place, it will read that symlink, see that it's pointing at the correct place, and continue. If it's pointing in the wrong place, it'll overwrite it. Suppose there's also fault recovery using this methodology. Suppose the file system where the mount point should go were mounted read-only. The script will fail at this step because obviously you can't do a make dir on a read-only file system. But you can remount the file system read-write, run the script again with exactly the same arguments. Just run it again. And the script will pick up exactly where it left off. It won't do the things that it had already done. It'll do the things that it hadn't done yet. Guarded commands offer verification. Because not only can you use the script to mount the file system, you can use it to verify that it's already mounted. It doesn't hurt to run a script that's written with guarded commands that's already been run to completion. So, unlike my friend who put mount in crontab, you can include this script in crontab. If there's a problem, if port map fails, the file system goes mysteriously away, the script will repair it and will repair only those steps it needs to repair to get back into the original state. This is very similar to CF Engine, and you know, I owe the kernel of the idea of this to CF Engine. There's also less tedious typing because you, as I pointed out, you can ignore many superfluous error conditions that before we had to check just because we didn't want the script to run away. Because the ensure block will catch it. You can concentrate on the important errors, the ones that will keep the script from getting the job done. So, instead of writing this, like we had before, with error checking code mixed around, we get this. We have a step with our error checking code in one place, and it's semantic error checking code. and the doing code in another place. So instead of this do test spaghetti that you get in scripts, especially large scripts, the larger the script gets, the more code you spend on checking your errors. The test code is together and the running code is together. But yet they're still encapsulated in a single step. So in a lot of exception throwing and catching mechanisms, you'll find that your error conditions go way far away from the running code, and you're jumping back and forth two or three screens to say, okay, what could have caused this exception to be thrown again? This keeps the check and the functional code closer together, but still separate. The second lesson is that with guarded commands, you can afford to be audacious in your script writing. So I had a coworker at one of the very first sites I worked at. He was a pretty good scripter. Actually, he wrote some really good scripts. But he had a fear of the outer loop. He would write a script and then run it 50 times at the command line with an argument because he was just afraid to let it go. He was afraid that it might screw up at some point along the way, and he didn't want to take that chance. And I've seen a lot of scripters who have this fear of doing too much in a script, and it's because they don't trust themselves to write a bulletproof script. And so they do little bits, they run them, they do the next bit, they run them. How many times have you seen a directory with scripts that say blah phase one, blah phase two, blah phase three? You know, this comes about because people, they want to feel like they're more in control. With guarded commands, you can write a single script that starts with a bare OS install, downloads and installs a lot of software, configures your users, configures your sudoers, starts all the software, and then goes off to a load balancer or a network device and puts the machine into service without a human touch. I've written such a script. You can write a script that configures a mirror server. It syncs 5 terabytes of data and then starts syncing off to other mirror servers. And the point is, you can do it just as easily as if you had written that original naive script that didn't have any, that was optimistic and just assumed it would succeed. The third lesson is that you should take note of idempotence, and you should turn it to your advantage. So, what is idempotence? If you may or may not have heard of this term before. A function f is idempotent if f of x equals f of x. In other words, a function is idempotent if doing it once has the same effect as doing it twice, or three times, or four times. There are many Unix tools that, when successful, at least, are idempotent. For instance, ln-f, cp, rsync. Some look like they're idempotent, but they aren't, as my friend with the mount and cron tab discovered to his dismay. Guarded commands draw a lot of their power from their idempotence. A completed step is idempotent, provided that you don't write ensure blocks with side effects. If your ensure blocks are tests, your steps will be idempotent. And this is how scripts manage to pick up where they left off, because a step can be run again and again and again, and it will only do something its first successful run. Or I should say, until its first successful run. For this reason, scripts using guarded commands are best when everything that has a side effect, and when I say side effect, I don't mean side effect in the programmatic sense of setting a variable, but I mean in the sense of affecting the external environment in some way that will persist beyond the life of the script. If you make sure that all such code that has side effects is inside a using block, then the script as a whole will be idempotent once it's run, and you can use it for verification. It'll pick up where it left off, and so on. This makes scripting with guarded commands procedural in nature. You decompose the task into procedures called steps. And everything is run via procedures. It doesn't necessarily have to be like the script that I showed you before, where it's step, 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 step. You can, of course, go into loops. You can, of course, do if statements. But the actual side-affecting code remains in your using blocks, and that causes the script as a whole to be idempotent. Because execution of a procedure is controlled by the ensure test, a script written this way, with ensure blocks without side effects, with all side affecting code in using blocks, is using a new programming methodology. Actually, it's what I was talking about at the beginning, that we didn't have a new scripting methodology. And it's procedural, test-oriented script. If I can go into infomercial mode at this point. But wait, there's more! Commands Guarded has some other tricks up its sleeve. You can do sanity checks. A sanity block can be added that must be true before and after a using block. So, for instance, if you're uncomfortable writing into your FS tab, and the reason you're uncomfortable is you're wondering whether I'll clobber my boot partition, well, you can just create a sanity check that there is a boot partition in the FS tab. It must be true before and after a using block is run. You can create rollbacks. And a rollback will be run when any later ensure, including the one in the step itself, fails after the using block. The step still fails, and an exception is still thrown, i.e. the script dies. But the rollbacks are executed first. So for instance, in this case, we were doing a script that needed no login to be set. And let's assume that we didn't want to leave no logins in place. Say this is run by crontab. You know, you don't want to be locked out of the machine because something went wrong. So you set a rollback of unlinking etc no login. You can get step objects. I've only shown you so far steps that are kind of bare. But you can also assign them to a variable. If you do that, execution is deferred. The step is not run immediately. So if you're reading this as, well, I'm going to get the return code for makedir, that's not what's going on here. You're actually putting into makedir this entire step, which is being held onto and held for deferred execution. Notice that we have shift and we have shift. So it's a subroutine, and we're calling in arguments. And so then later on, for each one of these directories in this array, we use that variable, and we tell it to do. That's a mistake. That should be dollar underscore. My apologies. You tell it to do that particular directory. For cases like the before, there's a do for each method. And all ensures will be run first, followed by only the relevant usings, that is, the ones that the ensure step failed. So, for instance, you can say make dir do for each dirs, and it will check, do the dash d check on all of the various directories, and then it will only go to the make dir on the ones that are appropriate. This is useful sometimes when you're opening a file and you want to save a backup. You don't want to open the file if five times and create five backups, because now, you know, in the most simple way of writing such a thing, you now have only one backup from the step that you wrote, that you did just a few seconds ago. So that can be useful for those sorts of circumstances. So I tore through this talk quite a lot faster than I was expecting. But I would like some questions, and anything that you'd like to throw at me about either the things I've talked about or the module itself. And again, commands guarded, it's available on CPAN, and you can read the man page for more info. You can read the man page on search.cpan.org without actually having to download the whole thing. So, thank you.
This is great stuff, Trey. I really appreciate it. But two questions that I have. First is, what if the rollback fails?
Yes. So that's, of course, possible. And you're warned, first in the man page, for instance, you're warned not to to throw an exception in a rollback. Or if you do, you need to put it in an eval block so that the next and the next and the next rollback will run. They're run from bottom to top, as you would expect, right? They're first in, last in, first out. If I went back and forth about this. So as I was implementing it, I put rollbacks in evals, and then I took rollbacks out of evals, and I put rollbacks in evals, and I took it back out of evals. And what I finally decided was that I needed to push this to the user of the module, because there's no way to get out of an eval, but you can put in an eval yourself. So my point is that there may be legitimate circumstances where you want a single rollback to be able to hijack the whole script and end the program, and I want to allow for that. Now, there is a clear rollbacks facility. You can clear prior rollbacks, and so my hope is that people will use that, and you can actually put that in a rollback. You can say in the rollback, clear the prior rollbacks. So so it's not quite an answer to your question, but I've thought about the issue, and I'd love to hear any suggestions that you have.
Yeah, one suggestion I'd have for that is a variable that would default to having them in evals, but if the person set the system-wide or the library-wide variable for that script, it would take them out of the evals. Do the safe thing by default for most users.
Yeah,
give them the bullet to shoot themselves in the foot if they want it.
Right.
So
yeah,
Go ahead. I was gonna say, the second question you've already touched on a little bit, which is nesting. Can you nest these? How complex a transaction?
Yes.
Essentially, can you create transaction semantics with this?
Yes, ACID absolutely.
Semantics with
so absolutely, and I've done that in some of the scripts that I've written for my own use. They nest quite fine, and so you can create dependency trees of conditions that way. You can also use the ensure clauses of other steps as a part of an ensure clause of another step if you want to do dependencies in that way. That's actually not documented in the man page right now. A later rev, I'll document how to do that. If I could back up to the prior point for a moment, I think what you say is a good idea, that there's actually already a verbose flag that you can set, which some people like to only see messages when a step fails, and some people like to see, I'm about to do this step, and I don't need to do it, so I'm skipping it. And so you can turn verbosity on, and it'll print those little things to standard error as it goes along. So I think I could use the same approach for the rollbacks.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Hi, Trey. Obviously, it seems to me that all the same ideas could be used for other scripting languages besides Perl, right? And for those of us who do lots of shell scripts, or I still use awk for a lot of stuff. So was this very difficult to implement? I mean, for the basic stuff, would I have a lot of trouble trying to implement some similar kinds of subroutines in other scripting languages?
Sure. So any language that allows you to pass code around with a lexical scope should be able to do this. So what that means is Python, yes. Ruby, yes. The shell languages, probably not, although you could probably fake it out without quite so many features. Corn shell, you could do it, certainly. Mm-hmm. That's right. Yeah, yeah.
I mean, you know, as soon as you have to deal with variables, the situation gets complicated, because if the code is executed afar, will the scope that the code was defined in still be existing when it's executed? Mm-hmm. And so for that reason, you need a encapsulated closure, which is what Perl provides. The most interesting thing about implementing this, actually there were two. One is that this is a hybrid module. It's object oriented, as you saw from the do and do for each and so on. But because it's also a control flow, you know, with these steps, I had to come up with a mechanism using kind of ugly function prototypes to make that happen. And secondly, all of those blocks, you know, there's all these different blocks, the ensure, the using, the rollback, the sanity, you can add more. They all are basically the same thing. They're a subroutine that also have a little, like, little tab of data, a little flag. I'm an ensure block. I'm a using block. And so what I actually did was I each of these blocks, when they're called, they bless themselves into their own name. So if you say ensure, it blesses into a commands guarded block ensure, or sanity, commands guarded block sanity, so on and so forth. Because they all do the same thing. So that way I didn't have to clutter the code with a lot of, you know, possibly, completely redundant, you know, code for each of those blocks. So it's worth a look. It has some interesting ideas in the implementation. Andrew.
You know, this sounds kind of funky, but three things sort of immediately come to mind. One is, so I guess just a comment, this is morally equivalent to decomposing what you want to do into a finite state machine and essentially saying, here's my state, here's how I can tell I'm in this state, and here's what I need to do to progress to another.
Yes.
And certainly not all things you want to do decompose in this way or decompose easily. But that's just sort of an observation. You've undoubtedly covered that, or at least come across those. The second thing is, this runs into a problem if the computation you need in the guard is expensive. Right? I mean, in the cases you've had, they're just trivial things. Look at this text line or something like that. But if it takes 10 minutes of CPU time to compute the guard, then this loses a lot of its allure.
Yes.
And I guess the third thing is, how do you do loops? How do you sort of handle the general issue of loops where it may be quite a difficult... I guess this is a subset of the previous one where it's hard to know if you've done all 10,000 times mm-hmm. through the loop. Mm-hmm. And so the guard becomes complicated. The guard is around the whole loop.
Yes.
How do you address that sort of thing?
Yes. So I've been thinking about that. And obviously, by definition... you can't memoize the ensure guard, right? Because if you memoize it, the whole point is that it's going to have it. You hope it will have a different value later, right? That it'll be false now, but it'll be true later. And so caching doesn't really work in this case. And so what I've been thinking about is that there is a memoizing facility in Perl. I've been thinking about how I could expose that so that you could mark certain sections of an ensure as invariant, or not invariant, but will be the same the next time around. And then you could only you could include both the code that you know will be the same down the road and the code that you think will be different, and have it compute the first only once. Is that an answer to the first part?
Yeah.
Yeah. The second part with loops, it behaves fine in loops. I mean, obviously, you are having to do the using check and the ensure check and the using block. The reason that I exported that do for each method is because it is a little less expensive to do it that way, because it'll only run the ensures necessary and then only the usings necessary, rather than going back to the ensure again.
Hello, I'm David Snyder. I just had a quick question about how, I was just curious how all this looks inside of the Perl debugger. I use that on all of my code just to kind of make sure that it does what I believe I intended for it to do.
I'm sorry, you're going to have to start over. I'm having trouble understanding you.
Okay, I'll talk a little slower. I use the Perl debugger, like many folks here, a lot in my code, kind of religiously. Any lines that get changed, I walk through it again to make sure that they look like they're doing the right thing. And since this module, as you mentioned, kind of modifies the control flow,
yes.
What does that do to the debugger? Does it drive it crazy? Is it kind of straightforward?
Well, it limits what you can do with the debugger a little bit. You have to use, so if I can find an example that I can show you, it looks like I'm going to have to. Navigate. Let me find an example. So, for instance, if you wanted to debug the using statement here, that's not a very interesting thing to debug, but suppose you did, you would need to set a breakpoint at the line number, because there's no way that this is anonymous. It's a using block, and so there's no way to set a breakpoint on by name. If you set a breakpoint by line number, it'll work just fine, even if the step gets called again and again and again. It looks a little funky in the debugger as far as what it thinks the current scope is, because it says, well, I'm in the using caller space of anonymous code ref, blah, 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 of the step, blah, 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 blah. And so, you know, it gives, you know, the command line that you have in the debugger is pretty darn long, but it's completely usable if you just use line numbers.
Cool. Look forward to giving it a try. Thanks.
Sure. Thank you.
So I had two comments. One of them is about, in fact, this very example. You're sort of cheating here by relying on the fact that the service start is already an impotent. Because you have an and in your check, you are going to redo both starts if one of them has failed.
Yes, right. So I had a slide for that, and did I skip it? Let's see. It doesn't look like I can cruise quickly. Ah, there we go. So I thought in this section I had included in talking about idempotence, because I don't think I ever actually got into why you would use it to your advantage, which was the lesson. Let's see. Sorry about this. I don't know how to skip multiple. Nope. So I meant to include that very code, and I will escape and go more quickly back. There we go. What I meant by, you know, take note of idempotence and use it to your advantage. Well, it doesn't hurt to start port map again. So you can start port map 15 times because the service command will notice it's already running and just kind of say already running. So because of that, it doesn't hurt if in fact what failed was NFS lock and port map's already running. You'll still go through, you'll try to start port map again, it'll fail, but you don't check that. You're checking the semantics that both are running. And then it'll start NFS lock. I'm sorry? Why guard it at all? Because you want to fail at the end of the step when both port map and NFS start lock should be running if they are not. Because your very next step is going to be to mount the file system. And so if those services aren't running, then you're in trouble. So that's why you guard. That's why you guard the hole. But just like I didn't check the error code of open, I don't need to check the error code of port map, because so what if it's already running and so trying to start it fails.
And about not checking the error code on open while we're there, that's a lot of fun. But now I'm missing in the output some information that was going to be a big use to me in figuring out what the hell happened. That the FS tab write didn't succeed, but that die was going to tell me that, you know, the open failed because FS tab wasn't there, or that, it wasn't, or I didn't have permission,
yep,
or whatever, and
yep,
that,
yep,
information is gone.
Yep, so I actually have an answer for you, Elizabeth. I didn't describe this. So
not in the 0.1 version that's on CPN now, but in the next version. What it does is it checkpoints dollar bang, which is the error code. If it changes in failing, it will print out what dollar bang was, along with saying this step failed. So you still get that error message out.
This is really interesting stuff. It's nice to see things broken at a state machine level. The issue I guess I'm curious about is how rigorous you've been in the testing of multiple requirements to meet a particular state before you move forward. The example you had up there was a simple AND. But what do you do when there are multiple dependencies prior to multiple conditionals prior to state change? For instance, this and this and this, unless this or this. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I mean, there are a number of places, and the reason I'm pulling this out is Larry Wall, a long time ago, wrote the core of what eventually is now a commercial product called Nerve Center that's all about state machine structures. And debugging those state machines when there are multiple conditionals gets to be really interesting, and the rigor in that test concerns me a little.
So let me show you. I'll just use CPAN to prove that it works. It may not be big enough, so if so, I'll figure out a different way to show you. But in the man page that's currently on CPAN, there is an example in... Oh, there we go. I passed it. Hopefully you can read this. InsureBlocks are subroutines. So you can do very complicated things of multiple lines, and just so long as you return a Boolean for one or the other. And so that's what I do. If the step is small, I run it on a single line. I write ensure curly brace step curly brace. If the step is a little longer, I'll write it on multiple lines, but I'll concatenate them with and or as necessary. But if it gets much beyond that, I'll break into a more procedural form, and I'll return zero or one based on what I want to have happen.
Very cool stuff. Thanks.
Yeah. Thank you.